Welcome to the 12 Days of Podcasts. This series of 12 perfect episodes is brought to you by the good people at Def Jam. Last night, December 15th, Jeezy dropped his new album, Pressure, and maybe you heard it, but you definitely haven't heard me talk about it enough. You might be wondering, what's the song you want to hear out at the club, Jeff? I'd say track 5, This Is It. It is low-key and hypnotic. I would play it everywhere. The club, the grocery store, those are the only two places I go. You can't ban the snowman, but you can buy the album at JeezyShop.com.
Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Eric.
How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. 12 days of podcast. This is day number
4.
Okay, so we did the Q&A episode for episode 150. We followed that up with the year-end review of music. That was with Rembert and Naomi and Phil and Scotty Beam and Jinx. And then we followed that up with Upscale Vandal.
Yeah.
Right? And today.
Today in the podcast, we have Carly Hustle.
But before we get to that,
oh,
I did want to mention.
Yeah.
That if people didn't hear yesterday, the big news is we are coming back to New York City, Jeff. We're here, but we're coming back to New York City. We are going to be on stage doing a live podcast on January 10th, 2018 at SOBs. Jeff, we've sold out venues in New York.
Yes.
In London.
I remember.
We went to Los Angeles and packed
there.
The room.
Yeah.
We have done a lot of great shows. Guys, if you haven't seen us live, you are really missing out. So here's your chance, especially if you're in any of the boroughs of New York City. We're talking Bronx.
Oh, yeah?
We're talking Brooklyn. We're talking Staten Island.
Where else?
We're talking Queens.
What? Huh?
We're talking about... What am I missing?
Manhattan?
Manhattan.
That's too far.
If you guys are anywhere in the general vicinity, you know what? If you're out of town, fly in for the show. It's going to be a dope show filled with comedy, music, and storytelling. Guys, you do not want to miss this. Tickets are available right now at itsthereal.com. Get your tickets before they sell out. And now, Jeff.
Oh, yeah?
Who's on the podcast?
Today on the podcast, we have radio veteran and host of the Brutally Honest podcast, Carly Hustle.
Yes, Carly, who is originally from Eugene, Oregon. We talk about her early jobs at Kinko's and Applebee's, escaping to Portland after sort of going to college, and how she found the attention of Ebro Darden. You know, Ebro in the morning over at Hot 97.
She talks about going up and down, well, mostly just down the West Coast.
Yes.
Down to Salinas, beautiful Salinas, California,
right.
Then San Diego, then Phoenix.
Right.
And then finally making her way over to Hot 97.
Yeah, we talk about Funkmaster Flex. We talk about Angie Martinez. We talk about Summer Jam. We talk about programming the Who's Next stage.
Her work with Rhapsody and Ninth Wonder.
Oh, man.
We talk about Apple. We talk about Kendrick Lamar, a lot of stuff.
We talk about a lot of stuff. Carly is a great personality. She is a great mind, and we were thrilled to finally have her on the podcast.
I mean, we just want her on the podcast so we can get her daughter on the podcast.
She's a star. Shout out to Harp. Jeff, when do you want to get into this?
Right after I say who's on the podcast tomorrow.
Who is on the podcast tomorrow?
Because this is a never-ending series of podcasts, the 12 Days of Podcasts. We have Fafu Faflin. He's got stories about Prince.
Well, you know, people may have heard him on our podcast right after Prince died. We talked to Fafu for about a half an hour about programming drums with Prince, going out on tour with Prince, being at Paisley Park, talking about Minneapolis to, you know, the nth degree.
He's on the podcast. He's talking about Puff Daddy. He's
yes.
talking about the Blue Man Group.
Yes.
He's talking about just a whole, like, Fafu is our Forrest Gump.
So this is tomorrow's episode.
Yes.
Today on the episode, Carly Hustle.
Yep.
Tomorrow Fafu.
Gotcha. And then there's an interminable amount of other episodes coming up.
But Jeff.
Yes.
When do you want to get into this one?
Right now.
Yo, what up? It's Eric, a.k.a. Marty McFly, Doc Brown, and Biff Tannen, a.k.a. Future Hive.
Yo, what up? It's Jeff, a.k.a. Embrace the Hate, a.k.a. Hug the Block.
Yo, what up? It's me, Carly Hustle, a.k.a. Carly Hustle. I just have the one name.
Yeah, this is a waste of time, but it's the real. Bow, 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 bow,
bow. See, your name is so nice that you say it twice.
That's right.
Absolutely. I think it's necessary. It's sort of like New York, New York.
That's right. Carly, welcome to the Upper West Side.
Thank you so much. I don't spend a lot of time in this area because I live in Brooklyn.
Yeah. Right.
Also, why would you ever come up here?
Exactly. It's so far. If you live in Brooklyn, this is like, I'm surprised we're friends, to be honest, because you guys live far.
Yeah, but we really do.
We always converge like somewhere in the lower Manhattan area, which is like a good middle ground.
Or just on Twitter. You know? We don't have to talk anywhere except for Twitter.
It goes down in the DMs from time to time.
How many different places have you lived in New York City?
Ooh, I've lived in 6 apartments.
Whoa.
Yeah. Name
their addresses.
I don't remember. But they were all in Brooklyn.
So we've never moved, right? Like, we moved the one time into this apartment, and then I've stayed here since then.
I think that's the smart way to do it, because that way your rent doesn't go up every single time.
Agreed.
And as the rents go up, like, this apartment is probably like a $1 apartment.
That is the nicest thing anybody has ever said.
Well, in 2017.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe a few years ago, it would have been like, maybe a $1. Where are we going?
It started off like an average thing, and then they cut it by
a third
out of nowhere,
just because they were benevolent people. They were like, we don't want to lose people who pay rent.
Yeah, we don't know what it was. So like, just out of nowhere, they were like, hey, by the way, your rent is, and then that's why we've never been able to leave, like, or never would leave.
Yeah,
for now.
Stay here.
But is moving,
I'm going to die in this apartment.
is moving the worst experience?
In New York City, it's not particularly fun, but I've actually moved probably 20 times in my life.
Oh,
and I've
God.
Also lived in 6 cities.
That's a lot.
Yeah, so it's just moving as a part of my life. Soul. I'm kind of nomadic.
Wow. Well, where are you originally from?
So I'm originally from Eugene, Oregon.
Right.
Wow.
Yes. Wow.
Born to run.
It would be terrible if there wasn't the University of Oregon, which kind of brings a bit of a pulse. And, of course, the Ducks.
Yes.
Go Ducks.
Go Ducks. Yeah.
You say that with such conviction.
Well.
Do you hate Oregon State?
Yes. It's in your blood when you're born in Eugene that you have to hate Oregon State.
Right.
And you have to hate the whole town of Salem. And I think people who live in Salem hate Salem.
Oh, my
so
God.
I think that's fine. Eugene is like the much cooler version of a small town.
Yeah.
It's sort of akin to like an Austin or let's say a Tucson, like just a nice bustling college town.
It's sort of
town.
Like an artsy sort of place.
Yes.
Whereas if you go 15 minutes outside the city.
Do not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do not. Yeah. You don't want to do that. You definitely want to stay out of Eastern Oregon. Just generally speaking.
What is in Eastern Oregon?
Neo-Nazis.
Oh,
cool.
Yeah.
That's where they've gone.
So that's where I avoid. And tumbleweeds, probably.
Mm-hmm.
So and do they casseroles. A lot of casseroles with the...
You know neo-Nazis just love casseroles.
What do you call it? Cornflakes on top. It's a crunchy topping.
Yeah. It's a regional thing. Yeah. Growing up there, is there a sense that townies are like the lowest level of people?
What do you mean?
Wait, lower than neo-Nazis?
Not lower than neo-Nazis. That's in East Oregon, Jeff. I'm talking about like
Eugene.
In Eugene.
Townies.
Yeah, like people.
What is a townie?
Townies
people
are people
who grow up in Eugene and then stay in Eugene. Not, well, I mean, I guess not specifically Eugene. It's wherever the town is.
I feel like a lot of people did stay. I don't look down on them for staying.
Okay.
Well, why do you look down on them?
I look down on them because a lot of people made some bad decisions because they live in small towns, and what else are you supposed to do? So I don't really look down on them. I understand it, but I just didn't want to become one of those people.
Right. I do think that, like, so I went to Syracuse, and I think, like, a lot of out-of-towners come to Syracuse, and they're just like, oh, the people from Syracuse, like, we're only here for 4 years or whatever.
I see where you're going.
Yes. So... And I think, like, looking back at that, it's not right. You don't know what you're, like, born, like, into your city. Did you grow up thinking that you were going to go to the University of Oregon?
I did for a couple of terms, actually, physically go there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think it was sort of a goal to do that because it's a pretty prestigious university, especially because of the football team. And if there wasn't the football team, you'd really be screwed. And actually, their basketball, I think, is pretty good.
Yeah.
I sort of lost track. I haven't lived there in a long time. But yeah, I think the expectation was that I would, you know, graduate high school from South Eugene, which I did, and then go to the University of Oregon, which I did, and then I didn't.
Well, what are your interests at that point? Like, growing up, like, what are you into?
Bob Marley, you know.
How much did you smoke? Like, all of it?
Yes. Yeah. So when you're born in Oregon, you're pretty much born with a joint in your hand or a bong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure, because you are a white.
Yes. Or an apple.
Yeah.
Because you can actually, you know, you can carve out an apple and create a pipe
for
out
sure,
of it.
Yeah.
Or a carrot.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So these are all things that I have smoked out of before. I first smoked weed when I was 11.
Wow.
It's very early. We basically discovered some weed in a friend's dad's freezer.
Mm-hmm.
And got experimental.
It wasn't like oregano. Like, that's like actual weed.
No, it was definitely weed. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He was a big time smoker.
Was it good weed?
Yes. Yeah. I've never smoked any kind of swag. We don't do the Reggie. Okay? We're classy over there.
What was going Oregon. Through your mind as an 11-year-old who was instantly high?
I was like, this is pretty cool. I understand why people do it. I just kept doing it because everybody else was doing it.
Right.
It was just very socially acceptable. It was never condemned, never looked down upon.
Right.
It was just a part of the hippie culture.
And was that something where it was a one-time thing at 11 and that you like revisited in high school, or was it just consistent?
No, it's pretty consistent. Yeah, I think.
Always from your friend's father's freezer?
Not always. Then you start to kind of break away, and then friends have it, and then you can buy it from other people, and, you know, you find your guy or your girl.
Mm-hmm.
And you're, you know, in a consistent supply. You have a stash.
Yeah.
So I smoked weed, like, all the way through high school, some of college. But I don't
anymore.
Are
you high
I
right
just,
now?
No. I don't smoke anymore. I don't like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I sort of went through the phase, a long phase.
And now that it's legal, it's, like, not that exciting.
It's not.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not exciting when it's, like, you're not, you know, when you're allowed to do something.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Like, you're allowed to be on our podcast now.
I'm like, wow, like, what a drag.
What was 14-year-old, 15-year-old Carly like?
Well, that would be what, freshman, sophomore year?
Yep.
So I was a bit of a outcast, I would say. I was friends with everybody, but I didn't really have a core circle. I had singular friends in different circles, but I never ran with one crew. And so I think that made me slightly awkward.
I mean, as 14-year-olds are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had a mustache, you know. I went through the puberty mustache where you have to, like, wax it off. I don't get it anymore. I don't have to wax it anymore. It was part of the puberty.
People can't see you, but Carly right now is sporting a full-on Tom Selleck.
Right. So no more weed and no more mustache.
Right. Yeah, yeah, okay. Right, yeah. I had really bad acne. It was cystic acne. It's like a skin condition. It's not just regular, you know, puberty pimples.
Mm-hmm.
And that started to develop in middle school and then got really bad in high school. It started on one cheek and then happened on the other cheek. I think that was like a huge nightmare for me because I was like traumatized.
Yeah, you thought that it was like, you know, just the one cheek and then your other one started to just want to fit in.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Didn't
so it was
be
both, it was so bad that I couldn't sleep on the sides of my
faces.
Oh,
that's like actually bad. Yeah.
No, it was
like,
a horrible. Real skin condition. It hurt so awful. It was awful. And it wasn't until I was maybe 19 or 20, I was working at Kinko's, and this guy came up to me. He was like, my son has acne like you. I was like, oh, here we go again. Somebody's always trying to, like, give me a holistic cure or whatever. He's like, I don't want to be rude, but there's this new thing out. It's called Accutane. You should try it. So, of course.
And you said, fuck you.
I felt bad because I was like, he noticed it. But then I went and I tried it and it cleared it up. And
so that's amazing.
I've been acne free ever since. However, now there's like a class action lawsuit against Accutane.
Right. So I used Accutane as well and it worked for me. There are people out there who it did the opposite for.
What? I don't know what happens when you take it, but I didn't have any problems.
Yeah, I think it drove people nuts.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Is that like the reason why?
It was like an insidious, like, sort of.
Yes. Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
I guess that explains some things. Yeah. I thought I wasn't affected.
Yeah. What was your first job?
My first job. I worked at Kinko's. That was my first job.
What were you doing for them?
I was 15 years old, and they had a little coffee bar inside the Kinko's at the Eugene University of Oregon campus. So I started working in the coffee bar. I was the youngest Kinko's employee.
Shout out to you.
And then I was doing so good at that they were like, you know what? You're sharp. Let's have you just start taking orders and, you know, laminating things and
copying. Did they let you laminate?
They did. Wow. I was really good at it. So I became like a regular non-coffee bar employee. And then I worked at Kinko's for quite some years.
Were you the manager?
I was never the manager. The manager, though, was always hungover and would come in Sunday mornings, like, puking her guts out.
Oh, God.
She definitely had a drinking problem. Mm. So, me, I was, like, 15, 16, held
down. You didn't have
fort.
A drinking problem.
No. 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 Luckily, yeah. So I covered for her. I covered for a lot of alcoholics in my life, but, you know, maybe this isn't the podcast for that.
Yeah, right. Let's salute the woman for showing up to work in the first place and then puking her guts
she
out.
She had
right?
the keys, so, you know, in order to keep her job in some capacity, she had to show up.
So so you're working at Kinko's all through your time in college, too?
For part of it. And then I started working at another coffee shop. Worked there called Coffee People.
Mm-hmm.
No longer exists. And then I started working at Applebee's.
Really?
I was a hostess.
Welcome to the neighborhood.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Your local bar and grill.
We have two signature items, the riblets and the oriental chicken salad. You can get the chicken grilled or you can get it fried.
Were you a good waitress?
Hostess.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. No, I was my a hostess, goodness. But of course, I excelled at that, so I became a waitress.
Wait, hostess is the low man on the totem pole?
Yeah, because you're the one that just seats people. It's not that much fun. Well, you don't get real tips.
That is true.
Yeah.
Did you split your tips with the...
Of course.
The back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Always.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why I tip 20% no matter how bad I'm treated, no matter where I go. It's because I used to wait tables, so I know
that. And even
that
before
life.
That, you were a hostess.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, okay. What happens when you have really shitty service and you want to let them know?
I don't. I just,
you just
accept
keep it, inside.
Yeah. If you serve me a plate of food with hair in it, I'm probably just going to move the hair over and keep eating.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
A bug. It's like, well, if it's, you know, maybe it's extra protein. If you can scoot it over.
Wow, you're so optimistic.
Yeah. It's because I know the service industry, and like sometimes there's going to be a gnat or a hair. And I think that there's probably worse food, like, stuff in the cans that we eat or the boxes, we just don't know. We're not paying attention. We just assume that it's sanitized, so we shovel it in our mouths.
Is this what you said at the hostess stand?
Yes. Exactly.
Wait, at Applebee's, they don't sing the birthday song. They sing like a different version of the birthday song.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember what it was, but I was still smoking at that time.
On the job?
But I do know that we had a little intercom,
mm-hmm.
and so when it was somebody's birthday, you would need to call all of the servers and everybody over.
Oh, my God.
So you would pick up the intercom and say, all apples to the tree. All apples to the tree. And I loved doing that so much, you guys. It was, like, the most amazing thing.
What was the most unique experience in terms of somebody coming in that you knew and had to seat?
Somebody that I knew.
Yes.
Well, there was this guy, Wesley, that came in and he hit on me first, and then the other server walked by his table and he also hit on her.
Oh.
And so
he was hitting on all the apples.
Equal opportunity.
All the
yeah.
apples on the tree. He was trying to take a bite.
Yeah.
And so we figured out in the back that that was happening. So neither of us gave him our number. And then a few weeks later, he showed up with another girl and she had a brand new baby and it was his.
Wesley. Just yeah. out here moving.
Play on player.
Yeah.
He was. That was a pretty good time.
What did you major in while you were at college?
I was in business, marketing, advertising.
With the thought that you would go into advertising?
I liked marketing, but I didn't really know what I was going to do. I was just taking the classes. And then I minored in Black Studies and Women's Studies.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just sort of all over the place taking classes that I liked and then trying to, like, jazz it up with some business. Yeah.
How long did you last at the University of Oregon?
2 terms.
And so one calendar year?
No.
Oh,
two out of three.
I see.
Yeah, 2 out of 3, because most people don't go in the summer, which is 4.
Right.
Oh, you had terms, not semesters.
I guess, yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And what led you to leave campus?
I left because I moved to Portland.
What was in Portland?
A lot of white people.
More white people.
Yeah. More coffee.
More coffee.
Fixie bikes.
Another Applebee's.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And a Kinko's. So I went back to Kinko's.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you plan on staying at Kinko's for an extended period of time?
I just wanted to be able to have a job as soon as I got there.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of didn't for a window of time, and then I got back into Kinko's, luckily.
What's the difference between Portland and Eugene?
Portland is a bigger Eugene, slightly more diverse.
Which is saying something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. It's really white, guys.
Did you ride a bicycle?
I only did because I wrecked my car the first week that I moved there.
The first week?
Yeah.
What a start.
Yeah, it was unfortunate. It was raining. It was dark. I didn't know the roads. The road, like, curved in front of me. And apparently somebody else had also run through the exact same curve because the signs were missing. You know how those there's, like, those yellow arrow signs that tell you to, like, curve? They weren't gone. And so I didn't see them.
Well,
so
that's
I
terrible.
Ran up into an embankment.
And were you okay?
Yeah.
But the car was fine. Not.
Car not okay.
Wow. Yeah.
Also, I was broke, so.
That sucks. So, obviously, like, the circumstances were just like, hey, like, I'm working at Kinko's, but did you have bigger, you know, fish to fry? Did you have bigger ambitions than that?
I don't think I knew what I wanted to do yet. I think I was still a bit confused. I knew that I liked music and that I wanted to be around music, but I hadn't found a way to do that yet. Eventually, I surmised that I would go work at a local record shop.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worked at Camelot Music first.
That's dope.
And then I worked at Sam Goody.
Okay.
And that's how I kind of like got into music. Releases, listening to music all day, all the time.
Were there any artists that were coming through to like do signings or?
Not really. It wasn't, I mean, it's Portland, Oregon. So there were artists coming through to do shows. It's a big music city for sure. But we didn't really have people doing signings.
Gotcha.
And what were the artists of that time?
Of that time, you would talk about, like, what is this, 99? So
DMX.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I was just going to say DMX, but also, like, the whole Master P, No Limit, every single week.
Every single one?
There was a...
Oh, well, yeah.
I'm saying every single week there was a new...
Release, yeah.
No
yeah.
Limit release.
Yeah.
It was that era.
Yeah.
And then, of course, because I was in the Pacific Northwest, there was a lot of focus on, say, E-40, mm-hmm. who's, you know, the ambassador of the Bay.
Sure.
And Too Short, and Mac Dre, and Mac Mall, and Lunasic, and a lot of these, like, Bay Area, like, Sacramento rappers, X-rated, like, stuff that people probably outside of that area would have no idea about. So we were very regionally tied to the Bay Area and Northern California for a lot of our music.
And what was...
Souls of Mischief, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and so what were you doing on your off time? Like, were you going to shows? Were you traveling?
I was. I was going to a lot of shows, showing up to every show that I possibly could.
Just to enjoy it or to, like, meet people or to see what the scene was like?
To enjoy it, to meet people, to see what the scene was like, to find friends, to find community. Because I think I moved, you know, from a city to another city and didn't know anybody.
And how far is it from Eugene to
Portland? It's about 2 hours in
mm-hmm.
the car.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it was still, like, the big city. Comparatively, it was huge. So it was, like, a whole new world.
Yeah.
So there was just tons of people to meet and tons of music to listen to. And it was a great opportunity to just get out of the town that I grew up in.
And did you like Portland?
I did. It's gorgeous. It's a really gorgeous city. It's beautiful. It's a city of bridges. There's tons of bridges. Has great views. Problem is, it rains in Oregon in general, you know, like 300 days a year. At least it did before probably this massive global warming
mm-hmm.
That we're experiencing. It may not rain as much now, but at that time, it was constantly raining. So, you know, it's an area where if it's 50 degrees outside, people are wearing shorts.
Whoa.
For sure.
Yeah.
So where do you go after Sam Goody?
After Sam Goody, I think I worked at a Greek restaurant for a while. And then eventually I met Ebro.
And where? How did you meet Ebro? At the Greek restaurant?
No. So I was still involved in the local hip-hop community. This was about 2000, and we put on a hip-hop in the park community festival. It mm-hmm. was free. Essentially, we had local poets and local singers and rappers, and they came out and performed. And we also had community people that were tabling and, like, giving away free literature. And so Ebro, at the time...
had hair.
He did have hair. I think he had dreads at this time still.
Yeah,
he hadn't cut them yet. And so he was working, doing the morning show at Jammin' 95.5. And he was, you know, had the wherewithal to get involved in the community and heard about this Hip Hop in the Park thing and wanted to, like, build with us. So he came to meet us.
He came to link with you.
He
and
did.
Then he came to build.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He linked first and then he built.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, proper.
Yeah. I mean, at the time, we were still figuring it out, but now that's the order of things. So it was great. He came and he was like, how can I help you guys? Can I help you guys get some artists up here? We will, you know, have a couple folks come up from Sacramento. And so he did. I think one of the groups was called The Cuff. I can't remember who the other groups were.
Wait, was it raining this day?
It actually wasn't really raining this day, but it was a covered...
God was looking after
yeah,
all.
Yeah, it was yeah. a covered mm. air structure.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it didn't even matter.
It didn't. So Ebro gave me an opportunity from that point, seeing me kind of put together this Hip Hop in the Park event, and said, hey, I'm going to get you on my street team. He had his own street team at the time. Then I got on at the radio station that he was working at. So that's how I got into the radio game in like 2001.
You jamming 94.5, you say?
Jamming 95.5.
95.5. Was that the Paul Allen owned?
Yes.
Okay.
Rose City Radio.
And... what? So you were on the street team. Were you running around, like, actually putting posters up around town?
Yes.
Wow.
In the rain. Yes. Tents, bumper stickers, everything in the rain. Setting up and taking down, you know, sound systems and all of that. Started at the bottom. Now I'm here. Seriously.
Did you drive a wrapped car with Ebro's yes. face on the side?
No, not Ebro's face, but we drove a Jamma 95.5 Hummer. Nope. At the time, Hummers were, like, brand new and super cool, like, street Hummers.
Totally, yeah.
This was a military size Hummer, though. Not like the
like Arnold Schwarzenegger. So it wasn't like a cool one. It was like a 1960s, like, Vietnam era.
Yes, it was Hummer. A legit Hummer.
Wow.
I ran over a water fountain with that thing. Yeah.
You ran over a water fountain?
Yeah. It was high up. I couldn't see it. I just drove over the top of it.
We are 0-2 with your driving right now. Yeah. So
it's not good. Yeah, I had a really hard time in Portland with my driving.
So, did you have to do? Oh man, what was the worst promotion or contest you had to do?
Right, like the one that I always love is that you have to keep your hand on the car for like, you know, 48 hours just to win like a Nissan Altima.
Yeah, I'm trying to think about that. I mean, we didn't do a ton of those. What we did do is like big festivals, like the Rose City Festival. And every year that would happen and it would be raining no matter what. And so people would just be out there spinning a wheel for hours and hours and hours, and they would win something terrible like a Laffy Taffy or like a sticker. Oh. Or every once in a while there was a decent prize. But it was pretty dull. We didn't have a lot of great contesting.
Was there a big hip hop community out there?
There was definitely a hip hop community. Emerging. I would say it was big, mm-hmm. but I think it was passionate. Somebody who's led the community out there for a really long time is this guy, Cool Nuts, who...
I'm sorry?
Yes, his name is Cool Nuts. I know. He's cool and also simultaneously nuts at the mm-hmm. same time.
Oh, so it's not a descriptor of
right.
nuts.
His Cool Nuts.
Yeah.
No.
Is it with a K or a C?
It's with a C.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. He's royalty.
Really?
He's Portland, Oregon hip-hop royalty. Yeah. And so he had a best friend, Bosco, and Bosco was somebody who kind of was able to get out of the Portland scene a little bit, and he was producing for people like E-40. He also did the talk box on Kanye West's workout.
Wow.
So
how did that happen?
It happened because he was involved enough in the industry over time, and he was kind of one of the only people that was doing talk box. And so people knew that Bosco was like the talk box guy. So he was able to get in, and he won a Grammy for that, I guess.
That's wild.
Yeah, so crazy. Cool.
So he's Portland, Oregon royalty also. Bosco and Cool Nuts are both, and then there was a group called the Lifesavers. Versatile and Jumbo, they were kind of more of your like real quote-unquote hip-hop, like your quote-unquote
backpacker. Oh, so Ebro loved them.
You know, I don't really know who he loved from that scene, looking back.
Paul Allen.
Yeah.
Well, he loved Paul Allen because he's getting those checks. You know, Rashid Wallace had a radio show.
We did find that out when Ebro was on the podcast. Yeah.
He had a radio show up there.
Do you remember what the name of it was?
Oh, man. God, this was so long ago. I don't remember. No, I don't. I just know that, like, He would have a lot of people come up there. Computers were missing. Like, entire computers were missing. I don't know who the people were. That show became, like, the bane of the existence of the radio station, except for Paul Allen kind of had to give him the show.
Sure,
it and was the computers.
Part of, well, and apparently yeah. the computers, yeah. So it was a mess. But it was a really good time. I learned how to do radio at that radio station.
Well, yeah, so, okay. Where is it inside you that you know, I'm going to go from music to working on the radio and I'm going to progress every step and go from street team to actually inside the building?
So I think I just put my head down and decided that I was just going to go with this wave. I didn't know that I was ever going to get into radio, and I was never particularly passionate about radio. I didn't grow up like, I'm going to be on the radio one day. I would listen to radio, but it wasn't something that was like calling me from my soul. I kind of thought I would work for a record label, to be honest. That was like...
You were going to be a suit.
Yes. That was kind of more my goal. Because mm-hmm. I went in for marketing. Like, maybe I would go do marketing at a record label or something like that.
In New York or Los Angeles, in your mind?
Maybe L.A. I have family in L.A. Mm-hmm. So that seemed like an attainable place to go. But, yeah, I never thought I would get into radio. I just was given an opportunity, and I was like, let me just exploit this to the fullest extent. Because if I don't, I'm never going to, like, get out of here. And I just wanted to get out of Oregon.
Yeah.
So, and I did.
How did you get out of Oregon?
I got out of Oregon after I was working on the street team for a while. I did a mix show on Saturdays for a couple of hours.
With Rashid Wallace?
No, he was not on that show. He was on Sunday nights.
And were you Carly Hustle at that point?
I was, mm-hmm. yeah. And I was Carly Hustle because E40 had a CD out called Charlie Hustle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I was the girl version of the E40 Charlie Hustle, which is actually Pete Rose's nickname.
Correct,
yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's Inception or something. somebody actually gave it to me at a record shop.
Well, and you were in the Rose City. It all comes together.
It does. It really does. I didn't even think about that. So I ended up getting an opportunity to do nights and promotion director in a smaller market. That's normally the progression for radio at the time, was you would be in a bigger market, and Portland was like a top 25 market.
Wow.
And then you would scale down to a smaller market so you could get a full-time position somewhere and then work your way back up. Wow. So that's what I did.
Did you care where you went?
Not really. I was just kind of open to, you know, continuing to exploit this dream for all it was worth. Like, Ebro gave me an opportunity, and I was like, I'm going for it.
It could have been Ames, Iowa.
Well, it was shittier than that, probably. I mean, not shittier than that, but it wasn't great. The first opportunity I got was going to be in Bakersfield. That's
California.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Then there was an opportunity in Fresno, also equally terrible. And both of those fell through, thank God, because I ended up in Salinas, California. Are you familiar?
I've heard of Salinas.
Right.
I don't know much about Salinas, if anything.
Salinas, Santa Cruz, Monterey, they're kind of like all in the same area. That was the market that I lived in.
Monterey's pretty.
Monterey's great.
Yeah.
But, you know,
Santa Cruz has the banana slugs.
The station was in Salinas, though, so everybody sort of lived in Salinas, because otherwise you'd be driving a very long time every day. There's no real freeways that tie this thing together. So I lived in Salinas. There were more murders there per capita than San Jose in the same year that I moved there.
Well, question, how many of them did you commit?
Zero. Because I would never snitch on myself.
What was your position at this Salinas based radio station?
I was the night jock.
Okay.
And I also ran promotions.
Night jock, like weeknights?
Yes, weeknights.
You were the Funkmaster Flex of...
I was.
Wow.
Of Salinas, California.
Yes.
That's right.
6 to 10, you get everyone leaving to go home.
Yeah, it's the mostly commuters. Kids. It's kids listening, okay. You know, at the time. I mean, this was years ago. This is before music streaming and, like, you know... And I was at that station when the first MP3 hit my inbox. Whoa. Actually.
What was it?
And I was like, I don't remember what it was, but I just was like, what the fuck? Delete. I just deleted it. I was like, I don't get it.
Just to compare markets, Portland's top 25.
Yes.
And Salinas is?
Like 75.
Wow.
Yeah. Small. So Salinas is like maybe 150,000 people.
And how many people were listening to you every night?
150,000 people.
Yes.
Clearly.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody. Just
people in the streets.
Well, did you
loved me.
But did you act like there were, like, everybody listening to you?
I mean, the cool thing about this signal was it was a grandfathered in signal, which means that you could hear it in San Jose, which was about 45 minutes north. So sometimes those San Jose radio people could hear me.
And you'd be like, we got more murders than you.
We're totally more street than you. Because that area, do you know much about the West Coast?
I mean, I know that it's there.
Like West Coast prison culture?
Yeah.
So Soledad Prison is very close to Salinas. Mm-hmm. And Soledad Prison, like, if you know anything about, like, let's say Mexican gangs, mm-hmm. they run shit really well from the inside of the prison outwards. So that's why there was so much going on in the street. So we would have to be very careful about things that we said, things that we played, certain artists that we couldn't play because it would be an issue.
Right.
So like Little Rob, who's huge in San Diego, he would never play him at my station. He was huge among the quote-unquote Mexican population, but not the Northern California Mexican population. The Southern California was fine.
So you
learned about a lot of those politics.
Are you the person who has to explain that?
I'm just the person that makes sure that I don't say anything stupid or give shout outs to anybody that could be inappropriate. You don't know, like, kids would call up or people would call up and want to give shout outs, and it's like, you're not for sure if you want to shout those people out because you don't know if you're stepping into like some sort of, I don't know.
Right.
Street war.
You knew that you yourself were not aligned with any of these people, but you didn't want it to be perceived like you were.
I just didn't want to be ignorant and do anything that would be culturally inappropriate or rub anybody the wrong way. So I was just very careful in that climate because it was just people getting killed all the time, lots of gang activity. It's just small town, like similar to like where I grew up in Eugene. Like drugs would sweep through that whole city and people would all get addicted to whatever that was. Salinas was that with like gang violence. Mm. Like everybody was clicked up with somebody. That was just kind of how you survived in that town. So
you made it out of Oregon, which was the biggest thing.
Yes.
Now you're in Salinas.
Now I got to make it out of Salinas.
Well, and how long would you give yourself?
I was there for a couple few years before I got an opportunity in San Diego.
Were you comfortable there?
No.
Okay.
No. I really liked it because it was the proximity to the Bay Area was great, and I really liked the Bay Area a lot. Mm-hmm. I had a blast. I would drive there every weekend, go to parties, go to shows. It just felt like at least I was close to a major city. I felt big cities calling me for sure, just because there was an energy that you couldn't get in a small town.
And San Diego was next.
San Diego was next.
And what do we know about San Diego besides a lot of military?
Yes.
And perfect weather, right?
Yeah, it's the same. It's 70 and sunny every day.
Yes. I was there for 7 months. It did not work out for me.
Your choice or beyond your...
No, it was my choice. Yeah. I had a boss. She has a notorious reputation. She's not in the business anymore.
Did you know this going in?
I did know that she had a reputation for being really difficult to work with. But I was like, I need to get out of Salinas, so I'm just gonna take it and figure it out, kind of what I'd been doing my entire career so
and really
far.
You've dealt with, you know, bosses who have done way worse, like throw up right in front of you, so,
that's exactly it's exactly right. I'm used to authority figures letting me down at this point. So I go, and I was on the morning show there, and I also tracked out middays, and I wasn't getting paid barely anything. I was getting paid the same amount of money to live in San Diego as I was in Salinas. Salinas was also expensive because it was so close to the Bay Area that they would try to charge you like Bay Area adjacent prices. And it's probably way worse now. But I was broke and I was getting treated really badly. I think I was really mismanaged. The show was kind of a mess. It didn't have proper direction. And I was like, I need to get out of here. So I started putting feelers out, and Bruce St. James heard about me. He was a program director in Phoenix. He sent Joey Boy, who was on the afternoon show at that time, and he was like assistant program director, I think, or music director, to call me. They're like, hey, what's going on? We're hearing you're not happy. You know, we have a spot for you here. Do you want to move to Phoenix? I was like, cool. So I got in my U-Haul with my dog and I moved to Phoenix.
So you just kept going south. Every single time you just kept going south.
I did. Yeah.
What was the conversation like with the powers that be in San Diego?
I just went to her and said, I'm not happy. This isn't working out. So I'm going to Phoenix.
Was there any chance that you would have left before you had another concrete job?
Probably not at that time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or else that would have meant I would have had to go back home. And there was just no way I was going to do that. So I wasn't, and I had no money. I had no savings. Like, I didn't have an opportunity to create any kind of a, you know, like, cushion for me to fall back on.
But at the same time, you probably felt like you had all this work that you've put in, and you felt good about that body of work, right?
Yeah, I did. But I think I was still sort of insecure because I went from a small market to a place that didn't work out for me, and I was like, is this career tanking? Like, what's going on?
And how well did you know the radio business to know that, like, a lot of people do have to move around a good number of times before they settle into the right job?
I learned it fairly quickly that I wasn't alone, and that if you wanted to be in this business, you had to pick up and leave all the time and sacrifice and continue to either move your family around if you had a family, or continue to just rebuild. So I've been doing that pretty much for 20 years. Mm. Yeah.
So you moved down to Phoenix.
Yeah.
And this is a bigger radio station now than even San Diego, I imagine, right?
Bigger than San Diego, bigger than Portland. It's the biggest one. It's a top 15 market.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, like, how does that change your behavior in terms of, like, are you on air?
Yes. I was doing middays there. Mm-hmm. Just middays. That was it. I just got hired for an air position. So I was on the air 4 hours a day. That was kind of it, which was a breeze. And...
are you taking radio calls? Like, we're talking about this topic today. Like, let us know how you feel.
Not so much for middays. For middays, you're kind of supposed to just
let it
chill.
Ride.
Yeah. Yeah. Just play the records, take some phoners, mm-hmm. you know, hook people up with like free lunch or something, and then go on about your merry way. It's strange because I feel like I have a lot of personality, and I was in like the most vacuous, vapid slot possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of was lame. So I tried to display my personality in other ways.
You were acting out.
Yeah, I was. I always act out. It's also a part of my personality.
Yeah, you were like starting fires.
Yeah, exactly.
How were you acting out?
I was just, you know, I woke up one morning and realized that I lived in a red state, and that freaked me the fuck out. And I was like, let me just go turn this whole bitch upside down, because I'm come from Oregon and yeah. now I'm living in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
If you can think about the more opposite politics, like, it's not possible. So I was like, I know that I could essentially, before trolling was trolling, I was queen of the trolls. I would just do things to push people's buttons. I would wear things to push people's buttons. I definitely was not probably what they signed up for. But people were...
thanks for getting me out of San Diego. Fuck you.
Exactly. Yeah. People were interested in it, though. They were like, okay, this chick's weird and she's different. And I definitely was trying to push the culture, I guess, a bit to accommodate for, you know, liberalism and feminism and, you know, all different kinds of... isms, not the bad ones.
what records were being played in Phoenix?
Mm. Well, like regional records, like you would definitely play a lot of Baby Bash.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, MC Magic, who is Phoenix royalty. We're going back to regional royalty. Yep. Here. Let's see, lots of West Coast hip hop, of course.
Any like, Lifesavers down there? No,
no, no. No, they didn't make it down.
Well, okay, so I have a question. It's my podcast. Every artist always says that their local radio station doesn't support enough. Not every artist. Let me rephrase this. Most communities will say, oh, our local radio station doesn't support the local community enough. Do you feel like, one, it's necessary? Well, I guess back then and now. Was it necessary then, and was it necessary now to support the artists that you...
did you support Juice?
I didn't know any Jews when
no,
I was...
no, Juice. The rapper Juice.
Yeah, we know
from I was like,
Phoenix.
There weren't any Jews in Phoenix.
He was signed to The Game.
Yes, yeah. Juice. Okay, so there was Juice, there was Willie North Pole.
Yeah, yep. Yeah.
G-Unit's own.
Yeah.
There was... so that was weird. At the time, this dude, Sin Q, there was Rockadala, a.k.a. I-Rock, Phoenix royalty. So, yes, our goal was to, at least my goal was, to find ways to support the local hip-hop community. It's always kind of been my passion.
Mm-hmm.
So I created this, like, Arizona hip-hop coalition and brought all these people together. And it was the beginning of some really strange activity getting everybody together, but we had a really powerful meeting at Steele Indian School Park. And I think people would probably still talk about that meeting to this day. All of these different people that would never hang out together came together because they had an opportunity to be heard by somebody from the local radio station.
You were Minister Farrakhan.
I was.
Wow. It's like the Warriors.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. So, and I also started this party with this DJ M2 called Groove Candy, and that also brought all of these different factions out to hang out at the same place. We didn't play local music at that party because we wanted to keep it neutral, but we did play like neo soul, hip hop, funk, reggae. We kept it like very family oriented, like probably just chill, like things that, you know, you would play at your family party. And so it was really dope to be able to like bring those people together. And I don't think that we played probably enough local music on the radio station. However, my whole career, we've never played enough. There's never been enough localization, I think, at any of the radio stations. And a lot of it has to do with how the rating system works. And the other part of it has to do with money and corporate interests and how those two things are hand in hand.
How hard was it to learn a new phone number when you went to a new radio station?
Sometimes I would say the number from the station before. Yeah. Or sometimes we would change the number for one reason or another, and you would say the old number. Yeah. That's so wacky.
Did you have any mentors that you could rely on if you were in a San Diego or a Phoenix and you're like, yo, I'm drowning out here, and you can call someone up for perspective?
That was always Ebro. Ebro's kind of been a constant in my career. So
he just won't go away.
Yeah. Him and also Mark Adams, who was the PD program director at my first radio station at JAMA 95.5 in Portland. I could call him. If I was like really hitting, you know, like a wall, he would listen to me. And I think those two guys were pretty significant in my career.
And how did Phoenix come to a close?
Phoenix came to a close, so I had quit working at Power, which
That'll
was the radio
it.
Station.
Yeah.
Yeah, I quit there. And actually, I just wanted to explore some other things, so I got into social work for a while. So I was working for a while at essentially what's sort of like a halfway house for teenage homeless youth. And then I got a job doing foster care licensing.
Wow.
And so I was monitoring foster homes. And then I was also teaching music business at Phoenix College. So I was doing kind of that work, more like teaching community work and, you know, really working with like disadvantaged youth.
Does any part of you at this time miss your old life in radio? Or are you like, well, this is more meaningful?
I didn't miss it because I was still doing weekends at a different radio station. Somebody had wanted to bring me on as a full-timer, and I just said, no, I want to do something else for a while. So I didn't really miss it. I found that I had a really rewarding and interesting life outside of it, and I think that's what I was looking for, was to confirm that there was a life outside of it, so that if I ever wanted to get out or go back in or whatever, I wouldn't move and operate with like a fear-based way about mm-hmm. myself. So, yeah, I was not expecting to get back in full time. And then Ebro called me and was like, hey, we have a job at Hot 97. I want you to apply for it. It was the music director position.
So one thing about the foster care and working with disadvantaged youth and homeless population, how did you – were you able to not take that work home with you?
It was hard. Yeah, I did take it home with me. I think it was really difficult. Yeah, because you learn about things that are happening to people, like unimaginable things. Like this girl was like locked in a cage for like the first 4 years of her life. And it was outside in the elements, and like she was raised by her grandmother and her uncle, and there was like abuses happening, and she literally had no verbal skills except for like what she could maybe hear from the TV. So like the only thing that she knew how to say was like commercial jingles. Was really awful. So like things like that where you're just not prepared to realize that this actually happens. You know that it happens. Sometimes you'll read a news story or it'll come across your timeline like, oh, you know, this atrocity happened to this kid. But like seeing it face to face and being able to like actually, you know, witness those people in their element and like what they have to go through, it was really challenging.
Why did you need that at that point in your life?
I think I just was tired of the music business. I was looking for something that was going to feel like it was more rewarding than playing the same song, you know, 100 times a week. So that's really what it was. I kind of like to do things that are different. Like if everybody's running in one direction, I'm kind of like running in the other direction. Cause I'm like, okay, that's going to be saturated anyway. Like, let me go see what this is about over here.
A Waste of Time with It's the Real's 12 Days of Podcast is sponsored by the good people at Def Jam Recordings, who have a ton of great projects dropping this entire holiday season. You know what song I've had on repeat for the last day and a half? American Dream by Jeezy featuring J. Cole and Kendrick Lamar. The perspectives of Jeezy and Cole especially are so honest to their own journeys. The beat is soulful. And if you can't rock with the line, "My president was black, now my president is whack," then you need to really reassess things. This album, Pressure, which is available on all platforms, I'm talking iTunes, Apple Music, Spotify, Tidal, Google Play, everywhere, is the truth. A million features from YG and Kodak Black to 2 Chainz to Rick Ross and Tory Lanez and on and on. Go to jeezyshop.com and pick up those dope packages, not those dope packages, but bundles of Jeezy gear exclusively on the website. And if you love rap, I just want to remind you that Jadakiss and Fabolous, our guys, have their collaboration album Friday on Elm Street, which is Fire Flames. Go stream that right now, starting with that intro track produced by the great Ted Smooth, and then hit the Swiss Beats joints like theme music, and then make sure to play that Teyana Taylor track, Talk About It. It's the album we were all waiting for, Friday on Elm Street. Go enjoy that real rap right now.
And so Ebro calls you up and offers you a new opportunity. How difficult or easy was it to take?
It was kind of difficult because I was just sort of settling into, I was thinking about moving to Thailand randomly. I was going to go teach English in Thailand. That was one of my goals. And so I was thinking about how I would get the certification for that and kind of looking into it. And then he calls me and he's like, "What are you doing?" And I was like, "Moving to Thailand." He's like, "No, you're not." He's like, "No, I have this opportunity in New York, and, you know, if you're interested, you should apply for it." And I did. And the reason that I did was I always wanted to live in New York City, and I think I was always sort of seeking that big city vibe. And I was like, this is an opportunity to move there and have a job and have some kind of infrastructure already. Like, I should do this, and I can move to Thailand and teach English anytime. I can't take this job anytime. So I decided to sell everything, give away everything that I had, throw away everything else. I moved to New York with 6 suitcases, and I just, like, rebuilt everything again.
Did you drive cross country?
No, I took a plane and just checked 6 bags and just paid for them.
Did you have a place to stay?
So Phoenix Royalty, Rock Adala, IROC, his sister was living in Brooklyn, and basically she let me crash at her pad for like 3 weeks while I was finding an apartment because I didn't have one yet.
And what did you know about Hot 97 before? Because obviously, like, you know, Hot 97 has been mentioned in like a million songs at this point, but what's the sort of national impact that a girl from
Oregon.
Yeah, Oregon, and a woman from Phoenix, Arizona. Like, what do you know about it?
I mean, everybody knows that it's legendary. I think that that's, like, a given. Everybody knows that, you know, the birthplace of hip-hop is, you know, in New York, and that this radio station has been narrating that story for a really long time. I think power had just turned on a year or two just before I got there. This was when Breakfast Club was like starting to bubble. So I was basically coming in the eye of that storm, where I think for a long time it was pretty chill. Hot 97 just ran shit. Power flipped on. They were doing okay, but really the function of Power was to take ratings away from Hot so that Z100 could be the number one station. That was it. They didn't expect Power to be anything, and they didn't really care if it was. I think it sort of accidentally became this, you know, the home of the Breakfast Club. And now Angie Martinez, you know, years later. So I think it was going to be a difficult time. The woman who had my position before, Jill Strada, she was moving to be with family down in Florida. And I think Ebro just needed somebody that was knowledgeable, that he could trust, that he knew was interested in a real way in culture and invested in that and was willing to come in there and learn and be respectful of that environment and understand what I needed to learn still, not being from New York, and not overstep those bounds and be as careful and thoughtful as possible. And that's what I think I tried my best to deliver when I moved here. I didn't take it lightly at all.
Well, okay, so what are those conversations like with Ebro at that time? Because this is your first time actually operating behind the scenes as opposed to on radio, and you have to... This is a real position of power.
Right.
Well, I shouldn't say power, because that's a loaded term. But,
I mean, I had been promotions director. I had been assistant program director. I had been a program director in an interim for a period of time. So I did have some of those, like, quote unquote, higher level management skill sets. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you know, I think we didn't really have to have that conversation. I think he just knows me. And so he just let me cook. Mm-hmm. And so the first year I was just put my head down, did my job. Observed what was going on around me, kind of just kept quiet.
What were your big wins the first year?
I didn't really have a ton of big wins the first year. I don't really go into positions trying to win out the gate. I try to assess the situation and like see who's playing, how they're playing, how to figure them out, how to psychologically understand them so that I can get things that I want to get out of them in the most constructive way.
Is that your attitude coming up here?
Yes. By the time we're done, I'm going to be moving into this apartment.
And so what did you learn about New York culture and New York radio wars?
Yeah, I'd been in radio wars before, so I was familiar with that, but obviously this is a much higher level. I didn't really realize how close power was to having their foot on our neck. I think I was literally coming in as that was just beginning to happen. They were very aggressive with digital, very aggressive online. I was always a huge proponent of being online. I mean, chat boards and things like that early on, like AOL Instant Messenger and Yahoo Instant Messenger and all that. I was there early doing all of the internet stuff. And the reason why I think I was so tied to that early is because I was moving around my whole career. And the only thing that stayed the same was like my, you know, Yahoo Instant Messenger handle and my Black Planet page, you know,
yeah.
things like that. Right. I kept moving, but like sickness.net, which was like a gangster rap website, was still there. And I would go and post with my friends, talk about West Coast rap. So, you know, I think, at the time, Hot was behind the curve, and I was definitely like ahead of the curve as far as watching what was going on and seeing that happen, but I didn't really have the power to say, hey, this is happening. I didn't want to get aggressive in people's faces about it, so I just sort of sat back and watched how things played out, and as that awareness began to arise, it was inevitable that we had to, you know, turn up.
Well,
in the digital part.
Well, what percentage of you wants to just like put your head down and focus on the work, and what percentage of you has to be aware of who's running behind you?
Well, I think it's both. But, you know, I think that the people who were there for years before have a much better idea of the landscape than I do. So I'm not just going to come in there and start like throwing my weight around. I wasn't hired as a consultant to come in and like fix things. I was hired as, you know, a support for Ebro and to just figure out the landscape. I think we started to have very frank conversations, and I was able to, you know, talk more candidly about how I felt about things after the first year because I had gained people's trust.
Mm-hmm.
They knew that I could just do the job, that I could get that done. And now I was able to take it a step further and be like, okay, not only can I do the job and do it well, and you trust me now, but now I'm going to tell you this, that, and the third, or now you can give me more responsibilities. Like when I took over Who's Next, for example, which I think was like, that was when my accomplishments, I feel like, at Hot started to materialize, was being able to call the shots on those early, be able to curate those Who's Next lineups, and really, I think, see into the future a bit.
Yeah, who were you bringing in for those concerts at SOBs?
So, like, Chance the Rapper.
I remember that.
Yeah, early on. That was, like, right after Acid Rap dropped, like, the day it dropped. And I had already been talking with his agent prior to that dropping. And we were like, you know, let's talk about bringing him out, but like, let's wait till this drops. Let's see how it's received. Let's, you know, so this, the day it came out and I heard Acid Rap, I was like, let's book it now for like next month or 2 months or whatever. And it sold out really quickly. My first, though, was actually Rhapsody. She was my first.
Wow.
She was my first Who's Next. It wasn't sold out. It was maybe 100 people in there. And I learned from that one how to execute better.
Which is how?
It's about putting together the right group of people on the lineup, not just the headliner, but your supporting acts, and kind of just gelling those fan bases. So, I mean, I started to become pretty successful soon after that. I mean, we had Travis Scott as a headliner. This was years ago. This was like five.
You had Kendrick. You had Schoolboy. You had.
I didn't have Kendrick.
Oh.
And Schoolboy happened. I think Kendrick was, if he was at Who's Next, I think it was before my time. I know that Schoolboy happened like right before I took it over.
Mm-hmm.
Not too far before I took it over. So Schoolboy is good. I don't think Kendrick ever had a Who's Next.
Do you think it's too late for him to do it now?
I wish that he would.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would be great. We could have nothing but taste makers in there. Opinion leaders, curators.
Yeah,
and,
all the gatekeepers.
Know, people who like to build.
How did your first summer jam turn out?
It was great.
What were your first impressions even like walking into Giant Stadium?
It was the biggest hip-hop show I'd ever been to. I mean, it's 60,000 people.
Bigger than your thing in the park.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Bigger than my thing in the park. Bigger than SOBs. But the thing about it is I think if you develop systems for things, no matter how big it is, you can kind of scale it. So I had small systems for SOBs, and then I started helping to take over running the festival stage, which mm-hmm. is between 15 and 20,000 people in the parking lot. And then I also did all of the work parts and scheduling and graphs and charts for the main stage too. So Ebro was the one who would run that because it was bigger stakes and people would listen to him.
Mm.
But I would run the festival and then the Hot 97 Who's Next. But I think that it's, again, if you have proper systems in place, it's quite easy to duplicate those systems and just scale them for bigger audiences.
What do you think people don't realize about Ebro?
I think people don't realize that Ebro's really a sensitive guy, or maybe they do realize it, because sometimes he tries hard to act like he's not. But he's a Pisces. They're fucking putty in your hand, really. If Ebro really hurts somebody's feelings, he will feel very bad about it. And instead of being apologetic, I think he gets angry, because I think he's angry at himself. So I think that's one thing about Ebro that people don't know, is that I think he's really sort of a sensitive dude. He's a kind-spirited person. He would give you the shirt off his back. And I also think that, you know, he has always been a grand agitator and a troll. I do think that living in New York has added some layers of grit to him. He was a little more chill on the West Coast, but you can afford to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different world. He's really dealt with things at a high political level in a very powerful position at HOT before, you know, obviously the power war came in, trying to then juggle the PD position and the morning show and all that. It was a very interesting few years that I was at HOT. There was a lot going on, a lot of change happening, and us also trying to like film a TV show, which was that random season.
Yeah.
But, you know, Ebro's a really good guy. I think sometimes he gets a bad rap.
Agreed.
So it's a question that we ask every single person who comes up here who has worked at Hot 97. Where were you when Angie Martinez announced that she was leaving?
Oh, yeah. Wow. Okay, so that fateful day. That one hurts still. I was in my office, and I got pulled into another office. I think it was me, Rosenberg, Ebro, and the new program director guy that's no longer there. And I think it was like Ebro was like, Angie's leaving. And I was like, okay. Bad. And then it was like, she's going to power. I was like, no! Like, the knife was in. It was like... the twist of that knife, you know, obviously you move from Phoenix to New York City because you want to work with Angie Martinez, right? She's like a legend.
I mean, I didn't move from Phoenix, but I understand.
You understand what I'm saying. Yeah. So, you know, I didn't come here to have not Ebro as my boss and not Angie Martinez on in the afternoons.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was kind of gutted about that. And then it was, you know, that awkward day. She was wearing sunglasses. She was really emotional. Everybody was emotional. Everybody was in the studio. I was in the studio for part of it, but for some of it, I just like was just listening on the air, like from my office, because I think I was just overwhelmed. But yeah, it was lame. I'm not gonna lie, it was awful. Like, I'm happy for her. I think she's done a beautiful job transitioning, not only from, you know, hot to power, but her book that's amazing, and just a lot of the other opportunities that she's able to get from, you know, having a wider platform with like an iHeart type base and Rock Nation and everything else. But yeah, it hurt.
What was your relationship like with Flex?
Came in, Flex definitely would just call me randomly and ask me strange questions. I think he was trying...
Wait, like trivia questions? Like...
No, I think at the time it was like... We were battling with trying to figure out, okay, this sort of pop dance music is very popular. Do we have to play it on Flex's show? These are the kinds of questions that you ask from a programming perspective.
Wait, pop like Lady Gaga?
Yeah, that kind of stuff, right?
LMFAO?
Yes, those kinds of records. Mm-hmm. Exactly. That palette, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my personal ovure.
Yeah, so, you know, I think he was, you know, Pitbull and like things like that that are huge across, you know, gotcha. The street is Z100, and at the time 92.3 was playing them. Like, everybody was kind of dipping into this space, like Flo Rida and mm-hmm. stuff like that.
So obviously. He was wondering if he had to LA it up.
Essentially, yeah. To stay kind of in the running. Like, is this something that you think that I need to do is kind of what he told me. And I was like, I personally don't think that you should do it. I don't want you to do it. How do you feel about it? And it just became this sort of back and forth. I think he was trying to see whether or not I was going to recommend that he play like sellout pop music on his show. At the same time, with an understanding that like, hey, maybe if you do a 15-minute set here and there, it won't be that bad. Maybe that will help, you know, spike the ratings at the time or whatever it was. I think what you end up settling on is that Hot 97 is Hot 97, and trends will come and go, but Hot 97 needs to be the place where you access hip hop. But at the time, and I think this is a discussion that happens at a lot of radio stations, when the ratings come in or as trends come and go, it's like, how much do you have to slip in one direction or another in order to just keep the lights on while this trend is happening? And I have to wonder, you know, what those conversations are like right now. They're probably even more serious. Not so much on the pop and dance side of things, but more on the, like, how do you keep up with this SoundCloud world? These records are not friendly to the portable people meters that people are carrying around. None of these tunes, like that Rockstar record, I can think in my head, that record probably does not test well on radio, terrestrial radio. And there's a thousand of records that sound like that. They're slow, they're trappy. That's not a palette of music that really works in a terrestrial space.
Why is that?
Well, if you look at like even R&B records, for example, so like when I was at Hot, this was a few years ago, you would know if a record was working, like a hip hop record. Between 250 to 300 spins, you could start to see it test whether it was going to work or not work. And some records would move ahead of the pack and others would slip behind. But with R&B records and any records that were slower and didn't have tempo, 400, 500 spins deep, you would not know whether or not it was working until maybe around there. So you're taking a lot more risk playing those records a lot longer to see if they're going to build. Whereas if you have like sort of a tempo hip hop record, you know that's probably going to work because it sounds maybe fun. You know, yeah. It sounds like a party and like it keeps people moving. I think terrestrial radio listeners are not great at listening to slow music. So this trend of like really slow sort of leaned out.
Right. Hip hop is R&B and R&B is hip hop. And
yeah, there's the lines are going away. What is hip hop anymore? Mm-hmm. What does that mean? So yeah, I have to wonder what those conversations are like, and it has to be challenging to maintain in that space.
It made Ebro pull out all of his hair.
Exactly. That's why he's bald now.
Yeah. Who shaved their head first, you or Amber Rose?
So it was me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Actually, interestingly enough, so when Amber Rose was in that Ludacris, We Know What Them Girls Like, We Know What the Girls Like video, I think it was called. That was like her first sort of video that people saw her as a bald woman, because I think before maybe she was wearing wigs.
She wore a wig for the Kanye video. Yeah.
So I know somebody, JC, who was, I think, Ludacris's DJ maybe at the time. And he knew me through radio, because I think he had maybe been in Phoenix DJing and came to Groove Candy or something. So he saw me as a bald person, and he knew Amber Rose through Ludacris, and he hit up Amber Rose and said, hey, there's another bald chick. Her name's Carly. She works at this radio station in Phoenix. And so Amber Rose requested me on MySpace.
Wow.
And she was like, hey, I heard there was another baldy. Like, I want to bald friends with you. And so we became MySpace friends.
Oh, I thought you were going to be like, so I said no.
No, I totally accepted her.
Well, did you make her your top eight? Like,
no, I didn't. I should have. Yeah. Because then I would have really been a thought leader. But yeah, she was kind of competition at the same time, bald girl competition.
No, I hear you.
So once she like really blew up, you know, we were already MySpace friends, and MySpace was kind of long gone at this point. We'd all moved forward. But every time I see her, she recognizes me, and she's really kind and awesome. Always sweet.
That's awesome.
That's really great.
So you're at Hot 97, and there's a lot of politics and a lot of seemingly a lot of changeover. When did you know it was the right time for you to leave Hot 97?
So they were having some management changes, and this is actually the same reason I left Power in Phoenix.
Rasheed Wallace.
No, that was a different station. That was the Portland one. Yeah, it's fine. It's been a lot of them. Yeah. Not jamming, but Power.
Actually, can we just talk about why is every radio station only one of three adjectives?
Power, jamming, or hot?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It must test well. I'm sure they've done some sort of test for it.
Yeah.
So I mean, I've worked for all
like,
of them.
Yeah, it's better than like bummy 93.9.
Yeah. Right. Like whack 92.7. Like, you know.
Yeah.
There's probably a reason why it's a friendly, fun adjective.
Yeah.
So yeah, there was some management changeover. And so this consultant was hired to come in, and he was kind of going to be the bridge between the old regime and the new regime.
So it was like Office Space, like the boss came in, they were like, hey, like
it was kind of like that. It was kind of like that in a way. They were bringing in this new general manager, and he no longer works there, by the way. He was let go.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were bringing in a new program director who also no longer works there.
Mm-hmm.
They got bobbed.
They did. And so he walks into my office, and he's like, you know, the new management, they just like, you know, they don't really know what you do here.
Yo, this is so Office Space. And you worked at Applebee's, which is like with the flair. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't really like to talk about my flair. So it's a continuum. I was like, okay, they don't know what I do here. I was like, well, they're going to find out because I'm going to not work here anymore.
Damn. That's so, what you said?
No, I didn't.
Oh,
yeah.
I so said great. It in my head. And then the next day or two, I presented them with my 2-week notice.
Wow.
I first went to Ebro and I said, look, I'm not trying to, you know, run out on you, but you're no longer the program director here. I came here to work for you. Now there's going to be a new program director. I don't like what's happening. It's not working for me. So I'm going to leave. He was like, are you sure? And I was like, yes. And he was like, okay.
Did Ebro know what you did?
Yes.
Okay.
And I think in the back of his head, he was like, these people are morons, probably. He didn't say that to me.
But he said it in his head.
I think in his head, he was like, knew all of the things that I did. I was kind of the glue that was keeping a lot of things together. And I wielded a great amount of respect from people because I always delivered. And yeah, I couldn't work somewhere where they didn't care to investigate what I did and instead came into my office like, you should be lucky that you work here because they don't know what you do. It's like, no, if you don't value what I bring to the table and you're not willing to come in and ask me about it or ask somebody else, then it's just not going to work for me. It was very millennial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
High-key millennial.
And how does Jamla get into your life?
So after I left Hot, I was just sort of like floating around on my savings. And Ninth hits me up and says, hey, you know, I know you left Hot. Well, you want to come work with us? We need like somebody to do some foot traffic for us in New York. We're hitting a wall with rap. Like we need to, not with rap, but with Rhapsody.
Yeah.
Like we need to be able to have somebody up there that's like making some shit happen for us. I was like, sure, of course. So we negotiated something. And the funny thing is about a month later is when Kendrick called Rhapsody and was like, hey, I want to put you on To Pimp a Butterfly, basically.
And you were like, oh, problem solved.
Yeah. Exactly. I was like, my job is going to be cake. So once that all went down, I helped them put together like a proper press run for her. It's not something that I'd ever done before. I'm not a publicist or a PR person. Nice people, but I would never want to do that for a living. And so, yeah, I just, you know, used Rhapsody as, you know, as talented as she is and also with the fuel of the Kendrick situation to come up with a great plan. So we just ran her through every media outlet in New York.
Was it just like payola?
No, what do you mean?
Just slide the bag under the table.
No.
Yeah.
Not paying for radio spins. Though DJ NF did give her some spins and she did not pay for those. He did it because it was the right thing to do.
Yes.
Yes. So that seemed like a very fruitful relationship and something that you can hang your hat on and felt good, but you weren't there forever.
No.
You got a job working at Apple.
Yes, I work at Apple. Apple, all apples to the tree. Oh my gosh, you guys are drawing a line that I never even noticed.
Your Wikipedia page is going to be crazy after this.
How do you get on their radar? How do they get on your radar? How did you know it was happening?
Well, it was Ebro again. Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah. Well, first it was Bozema. So Bozema wanted to hire me after I left Hot to work for Beats Music in the marketing department.
Mm-hmm.
So I interviewed with her and I interviewed with Ian Rogers, who's like a big Beats Music hotshot. Did it like via satellite with him because of course he's like in Rome or something important at the time. And I was going to get that job and then Apple came in and bought Beats Music. And so they did a hiring freeze. So Bozema at that time was still kind of even figuring out like what her role was going to be now that the Apple piece came into effect. During which time they were trying to hire for a global retail position. And it would be like managing different events around all the stores in Apple. And so I interviewed for that at Bozema's recommendation.
Hmm.
And I didn't get that job.
Would you like that job?
I didn't want that job. Okay. Yeah. I didn't want it. Yeah. It was like traveling like 40% of the time. And I'm getting a little too old for that. Maybe if I was in my 30s. But then you kind of like really need a lot of, I think, experience to have a job like that. So you're trying to get somebody who's older and tenured mm-hmm. to like want to travel
like an
40.
Old soul.
Yeah. I don't know who that person is, yeah. But whoever they are, they got the job.
Congratulations.
I didn't.
Seemingly, they have a better driving record than you.
Exactly. I'm sure they do. My driving record's pretty bad. So anyway, that fell through. And then I was just, you know, doing Hustle Bowtie and mm-hmm. doing some content for this website and just trying to keep it together. And Ebro called me. It was like, hey, Apple's going to have a radio station. I know this sounds crazy. I don't have a lot of details, but someone's going to call you and interview you. And I got interviewed and then I eventually got hired and I was under an NDA because nobody knew about Apple Music. They didn't know about Beats One.
Yeah. How long did you have to keep people in the dark for?
It was about 3 months.
Well, you were paid those 3 months though.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
That's a long 3 months to not tell anybody like what you're working on.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it is. It is. And it's also, you know, that's about how long it was when we found out that Beats One was happening to when it went on the air. Like, they turned that around very quickly. It was a complete crunch, but it was pulled off.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, how does your perspective change? Because this is now a global radio station as opposed to a...
you're not in Salinas anymore. Yeah,
yeah, you're not... So, like, you know, how do you cherry pick talent? Because that's a different sort of mindset.
Yeah, so we, in all three markets that feed up into Beats One, which is LA, London, and New York, kind of got on the ground and to try to figure out who was going to be on the air. Obviously, Ebro had already obtained this anchor position. And so, you know, we just were throwing names around, and like I was able to get Crystal on board, which was really cool. Obviously, she's from The Reed, which mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. part of Loudspeakers. You're right. Familiar with her.
Mm-hmm.
And got her, you know, some checks. And I think she was definitely like solidified in the podcasting world and was definitely starting to make some moves. But I think that it was a good time for her to have some extra checks. Like now she definitely doesn't need those checks, I feel like. Mm-hmm. You know, she doesn't need like an Apple contractor check here and there.
Everybody does.
Right. Well, maybe she does.
Yeah.
But at the time, I feel like it probably was fairly clutch like to get her, because I think now her ascension has like been really pronounced since then. But yeah, you know, I think Ebro wanted to bring Low-Key in, and he's one of our
So you
our
did not want to get Low-Key in.
Well, I did want to get Low-Key in, but it wasn't my idea, so I'm trying to give people credit for their ideas.
I'm just trying to, you know, I want Low-Key to understand who's in his corner and
that's
who's
right.
not.
That's right.
Low-Key knows that I am in his corner. I was the one that worked with him on the air early on. I was coaching all of the talent and trying to get them, you know, to be the best they could be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As a former air talent, I was coaching Low-Key. And so, yeah, what you hear now is a part of my hard work.
There you
go.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, Low-Key came in. We had, you know, a few other folks that came in. And it's been a good opportunity for people who didn't do this kind of radio to kind of learn the structure of radio. It's different because it's not Hot 97 radio. It's Beats One aesthetic, which is, I think, leans a lot more of like a UK aesthetic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You have a lot of Zane Lowe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Lots of Zane Lowe. And, you know, him being kind of the creative director of it, it's his vision, and his vision I think also stems from like his experience at like BBC and things like that. So yeah, it's been great to learn a new sort of way of looking at radio. And it's really radio, but it's, they're calling it a stream, you know, it's a live stream. Because radio, I guess on a certain level, that term has become a bit antiquated.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So yeah, I work for a streaming
platform.
A global live streaming platform. We've been building this plan. I think everybody in this new millennia is trying to figure out like what we're
what
doing.
Do you call?
Nobody knows, you know, you have to come up with new names for things, new ways to describe things, like, you know, what are genres now? How mm-hmm. do you name them? Do you name them? Like, these are all things that we're trying to figure out.
You should start calling it Jammin' Apple or, like, Hot Apple or something.
Jap-a-lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you had to step outside of this giant corporation that you work for and voice your own views through a podcast, and that's why you started Brutally Honest?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think not being on the air was sort of difficult for me at Hot because I'm an air personality kind of by trade. But it wasn't as difficult because I was able to sort of outwardly express things in different ways, like the lineups for Who's Next or, you know, the lineups for Festival Stage. I felt like people knew my work, whereas I think I didn't feel that as much at Apple. Just because it is a big corporation and a lot of things are very quiet and secretive. That's just the nature of the company. And so it's not a lot of like rah-rah, sis, boom, bah. And I've always been sort of a behind-the-scenes person. A lot of people have not known what I've done behind the scenes. Even when I was on the air, I was, you know, doing work like in programming and stuff like that. But I think that I just needed an outlet to express myself because I felt like I was just like disappearing into the wallpaper to a certain degree. And I think that also comes with being a new mom
mm-hmm.
and what that identity looks like and how do you flesh out that new identity.
Well, especially when your child is a viral star.
She is a viral sensation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that video is still going around. There's a little video of her peeking out from underneath a comforter, and it's really
with like, you know, 300,000 like retweets or something. Like it's
crazy.
Yeah,
and on Facebook too, and on Instagram, it's everywhere.
Has anybody recognized her in person?
No, but people recognize her dad. They're like, oh, are you Harp's dad? Yeah.
Is Harp friends? Is Harp MySpace friends with Amber Rose yet?
She's not, oh, well. Unfortunately. She'll have to earn that coolness. It took me a long time. She can't have it all overnight.
How has being a mom changed you?
I would say it's made me more aware of things on like a structural and generational level. I think that also comes with like my age colliding at the same time. I just turned 40 not that long ago. So you come of a certain age. I think for a long time you think, I still have time. I'm still young. Like I haven't attained this goal, but like just, you know, keep working and it'll happen. And then there comes a point in time where maybe you have a kid or you turn 40 or you have both of those things happen at the same time. And you're like, wow. Maybe I don't have as much time as I thought. I definitely have less time. Like, I'm a mom and I'm a careerist. And I feel like if I'm focusing on one, it's hard to focus on the other. If I'm focusing on the other, it's hard to focus on. Like, it's just this constant sort of tightrope balancing act. And so, yeah, I think that there are certain limitations. Maybe they're self-imposed, but I think some of them are just realistic that you confront when you're in that position.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me really look at generational wealth and like where people come from and how I can give my daughter more of a leg up so that she's can be farther along before I was. I didn't come from anybody in the music business. I didn't come from money. I came from Eugene, Oregon, and now I'm in New York. I didn't grow up here. I didn't have like somebody, you know, getting me an internship somewhere when I was 20. I literally built this, not myself, with the help of other people who believed in me and rebuilt it several times over. In my head, I think I want my kid to be able to at least access a lot of things that I didn't access until later, earlier. So it gives her a leg up, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. You may work for Apple, but that's very, very, very 444 exclusively on title of you.
Totally. It is. But I think, you know, I'm learning it earlier. I'm 48 years old, Jay-Z. It took a little longer, but damn. Women apparently mature faster than men. Shots fired.
Well, congratulations on a great 40 years so far. I mean, it's really an incredible journey, and
thanks.
We're so happy to have seen a lot of that in the time that you've been in New York. So.
Thanks for having me, guys. Well,
thanks for being here.
This has been a really fun time. I'm proud to be part of your, I think, is it 12 days?
Yeah. Welcome.
Is it 12 days of Christmas?
Of podcast.
Of podcast.
Yeah, we're Jewish.
Because you guys are Jewish. Yeah.
You try to support the Jews.
Yeah. No, I do. I try to look out for the Jews. One of the coworkers at my job brought in like a little Christmas tree.
Mm-hmm.
And I made sure that everybody felt comfortable with that. So, you know.
Did you see how horrible our lobby looks with all this stupid Christmas shit?
I saw that. Do you guys feel offended?
Yes.
But, yes. Like, not as Jews,
yeah,
just
no.
As, like,
an
you
aesthetic
know,
sort of
people
thing.
Who live in, yeah. in this fine building of ours.
It's so
horrifying. And it's one guy who lives in the lobby. Like, he lives in an apartment that's, like, not really an apartment. Right off there, he,
like, went to Party City and just, like, threw some shit on the walls, and now it's there.
Like, that was never the case in the other years that we've lived here. It's just ridiculous.
I think you guys need to, like, Hanukkah it up down there.
Yo, that's what we should do.
Yeah.
We should throw some oil over it and then burn it down.
Wow. All right. Or you could go to Party City and get some paper dreidels and stick them to the wall.
You know, we all have ideas.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Okay. Well, I just want to be able to come back to this fine...
Oh, thank you very
market
much.
Value. Yeah.
Thanks, Carly.
thanks everyone for listening to this new episode of A Waste of Time with It's the Real, day 4 of the 12 days of podcast. Jeff, if people want to find out more about us, we're It's the Real. If people want to find out more about this podcast, there's so many episodes to listen to. It's called A Waste of Time with It's the Real. If people want to find out where they can get tickets for our next live show happening at SOB's here in New York City on January 10th, 2018, where can they go?
You can go to itsthereal.com, buy your tickets today, and I say tickets with a pluralized S on the end. Go get your tickets today. If you want to listen to old episodes of our podcast or even new ones, you can always go and search for A Waste of Time with It's the Real on iTunes. We are also on soundcloud.com/awasteoftime. If you want to find any of our episodes ever created, just search for It's the Real on the internet. Something will come up.
There's a lot of material out there.
You can also find us on Facebook at It's the Real, Twitter at It's the Real, Instagram at It's the Real. We are also on Snapchat at It's the Real, and Twitch at It's the Real, because It's the Real was taken, and, you know, fuck these people.
Go to Spotify right now for our music and stream Sugar High featuring Currency and Smoke Dizza, 500,000 plays. We want to grow this podcast. Our aim for 2018 is to double our audience. We love our audience, but we want to double up. So here's what we're going to do, guys. We want to shout you guys out, and we're hoping that you will then in turn shout our podcast out to one other friend. So put someone else onto A Waste of Time with It's the Real. We know it starts with us. And so that's what we're going to do right now. Jeff, who do you want to shout out?
I want to shout out like 8 people.
Okay.
Who commented on our announcement that we were going to be playing in New York City.
Yes.
So I want to shout out the_JordanRules. I want to shout out Mouse Jones. Mouse Jones, who is probably the second funniest person that we know.
Right.
Right after Officially Iced.
Yes.
I want to shout out Brianna. I want to shout out Hey Phil Chang. I want to shout out Anthony Gebre. I want to shout out The Final Project. The Final Project, by the way, who is 17 years old.
Okay.
And seems to be every single place where every rapper goes in New York.
Really?
Yeah, he was just in Miami. He was buying shoes. He was at the thing that we were at where it was Upscale Vandal and Biggs and Andrew Martinez and Lenny S. And who am I forgetting? Clark Kent. They were all in conversation talking about the new Rockefeller Air Force Ones.
Right.
Final Project was sitting next to me, being 17 years old. I also want to shout out Jay Omega from the Officially Street Podcast.
Shout
and Sayer from the Officially Street Podcast, who I know will be in the building.
Jeff, I want to shout out our friends over at Genius, Insanul and Beef Red, who both reached out to us to say that they appreciated us shouting out, well, it was us and Naomi and everyone else at the roundtable for shouting out Genius and the video work, the dope video work they've been doing this past year. We're talking about the Verified series, the Deconstructed series, a lot of different videos that they've put up, and they have a very, very exceptional selection of videos on their YouTube channel. Check them out. Shout out to our friends over at Genius, Beef Red, Ninsanul. Jeff, we're back tomorrow with Fafu. Not for real, for real.
Sure, sure.
We'll see you guys tomorrow. Right.
This episode of the 12 Days of Podcasts has been sponsored by the good people of Def Jam, who just dropped Jeezy's Pressure on Spotify, Google Play, Amazon, and on JeezyShop.com. Go listen to This Is It, track 5, that song is the shit. See, Jeezy doesn't even need features on his best songs, but speaking of features, we've got a whole bunch coming up on the 12 Days of Podcasts. Tomorrow, we've got Fafu, who's got stories about Puffy, Prince, and the Blue Man Group.